Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman-Newfield. In her book, Beyond the Land, Diaspora Israeli Culture in the 21st Century, published by Wayne State University Press in 2023, Melissa Weininger theorizes a new category of diaspora Israeli culture that is formed around and through notions of homeland and complicates the binary between diaspora and Israel. Melissa Weininger is an assistant professor of Jewish studies at California State University, Northridge. I'm so glad her new book has brought her to our program. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So to get started, could you tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting because I wrote my training is in Hebrew and Yiddish literature, and I wrote my dissertation about some modernist literature from the early 20th century, and that was sort of what I had worked on for a long time. And I maybe came to the material in the book sort of accidentally, as one does. I mean, so I feel like so many of my academic projects and interests are things that I happily stumbled into. And I read this book. Actually, first I read a story, an excerpt from the book, The People of Forever Are Not Afraid by Shani Boyanju. And I became very interested in it. It's featured in my book, In Beyond the Land. But it is an English language novel in stories by an Israeli writer. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. I had not been introduced to the concept of translingual literature before, literature that is written by authors in a non-native language. And then very shortly after that, Ayelet Sabari published her short story collection, The People of Forever Are Not Afraid, which is also an English language book by an Israeli writer. And I thought, wow, this is a thing. It's not just a one-off. And once something is a thing, then it's something you can write about. And I started writing about those books. And then again, just, over time, sort of, once you kind of become connected to or a little bit immersed in a topic, like with everything else, you start to notice it everywhere. And over time, I realized that this was a kind of bigger thing. And that thing was something that we didn't really have a name for and that I called diaspora Israeli culture.
Right. Speaking of which, could you describe the scene from the Israeli sketch comedy show Hayahudim Baim, The Jews Are Coming, with which you begin your book?
Yeah, by the way, I love how you pronounce it with the Ashkenazi accent, because it's so like, actually, it goes along with the topic of what we're talking about today, because it's so antithetical, the Zionist ethos of Hebrew pronunciation, right, as over and against, diasporic Hebrew pronunciation. So I love it. I'm going to call it Hayahudim Habayim from now on.
I should just say, as someone who grew up in the Hasidic community and then left it, I'm working very hard to make my Hebrew a little less Hasidic and a little more sort of quote-unquote mainstream.
Oh, but I'm sorry to hear that, because I think it's great. And I think pronouncing it with the diasporic pronunciation is perfect, actually. So this is, for those who don't know, by the way, this is a great show, which Unfortunately, if you're an English speaker in America, you can't see very much of it. However, if you go to YouTube, type in "The Jews Are Coming," there are a few sketches that have been subtitled in English that are available on YouTube. Although in the last few years, their copyright protection or something's gotten a lot tougher, and so it's hard to find them. But this is a Israeli sketch comedy show that you might compare to like Saturday Night Live or something, except that its topics are Jewish history, biblical stories, and Israeli history for the most part. The sketch that you asked about features, it sort of opens, you know, with this kind of soft music, and it's all the biblical sketches, the sketches about biblical stories, open with a voiceover, you know, a deep voice that sort of sets the scene, and it says, you know, gives the year before the Common Era, with these, you know, Jews sitting by the banks of the Euphrates in Babylon, of course, where they've been exiled right after the Babylonian exile. And it sort of begins with some of the words of the psalm, right, by the rivers of Babylon. And it's basically these three people, you know, dressed in, I guess, what you imagine ancient Jews in Babylon wore. I'm not really sure how they figured that out. But it's, you know, it feels right. And you know, they're talking about to each other about how much they miss Israel, Jerusalem, and they're talking about, you know, people they know, and, oh, do you remember this guy? And yeah, and they keep saying, oh yeah, I wish we could go back. I wish we could be there. You know, I long for it so much. And then all of a sudden, another guy runs up and he said, hey, did you hear? Do you hear? You know, Cyrus the Great is letting us go back. And they're like, oh, wow, that's amazing. And then he says, okay, so are we going to go back? Are we going back? And then one by one, they each have these excuses for why they can't go back. And they're like, you know, they're great excuses. One of them's like, you know, I'd love to, but I just joined a gym. And, you know, you can't get out of those contracts. And another one is like, oh, yeah, you know, I want to go back. But, you know, we just built a new house and it has a pool, you know, and all this stuff. So they you know, these very quotidian excuses. And eventually the guy who ran up so excited is kind of convinced to come and sit with them and stay. And, you know, it's a joke about how diaspora has been a place where Jews have lived fulfilling lives that they actually don't want to leave. And one of the reasons why in Israel and for an Israeli comedy show, that's such a joke, is of course because of the Zionist notion of the negation of exile, namely that Zionism and the kind of foundational ideology of the state of Israel is predicated on the idea that the diaspora anywhere outside of Israel is inferior and in fact is undesirable. Early Zionists thought of the diaspora as abnormal and diseased. They used this language. I'm not just imputing that to them. And historically, that really has been the predominant feeling in Israel, among Israelis, and certainly in the kind of official rhetoric and discourse of the state, is that Israel really is the only or the best home for the Jews. And they're poking fun at that notion, right? That, like, look, we all know that historically, right, from the ancient period, from the time of Babylon, that's why we have the Babylonian Talmud. Jews have lived happily and healthily and well in many places in the diaspora. Obviously, they've also had horrible tragedies and been targeted and all kinds of things. But we also have lots of examples where that's not the case, and Jews, you know, perfectly happy to live in diaspora.
Right, right. So there seems to be a kind of tension, let's say, in the Jewish tradition in terms of the place of a Jewish homeland and the status of the diaspora. So you just described kind of one side, if you will, of this tension that Jews for millennia have lived outside of Palestine, outside of Israel, and that, as you mentioned, the Babylonian Talmud, which is one of the great bodies of Jewish literature, has its name Babylonian Talmud because it was produced in Babylon, not in Israel, and many many codes of Jewish law and books of Jewish philosophy have been produced outside of Israel. At the same time, there is this concept of exile within the Jewish tradition. What's the significance of exile for Jewish self-conception, and how is it evident in sort of daily Jewish life and customs?
Yeah, so I think my sort of, obviously I'm working on contemporary literature and not as much on the kind of historical, the way that the concept of exile operates historically, or golos, galut, right? However, in thinking about my book and the topic of my book, I think maybe the most relevant context to put this in is, again, the context of Zionism, which really did conceive of diaspora as exile in the negative sense, right? With all that comes with it. And a kind of exilic mentality or culture, right, that had developed around that. And that, when I mentioned before that, early Zionists thought of diaspora life and diaspora culture as abnormal and diseased, that was really the source of that conception, was that it was an abnormal condition to be in exile, right? That exile was unhealthy. And obviously this crossed with all kinds of other European discourses of the 19th century, right? There's intersections between those. But they sort of picked up on this idea of exile as a negative condition, as an unhealthy condition, as something to be corrected. And Zionism was the corrective. And I also, this might sound in a way kind of, sort of outdated, right, kind of way of thinking, but I can't emphasize the degree to which this kind of thinking sometimes still surfaces in Israeli culture and Israeli thought. Actually, I was just talking about having watched Israeli news a lot over the last few days, sometimes in that way too. One example, which I do include in the book, is that some years ago, and these actually you can find on YouTube, the Ministry of Immigrant Absorption produced some advertisements that to me seemed directed at Israelis living in the diaspora that really picked up on this negative notion of diaspora as an exile. The ads are things like, for example, you see a Skype call, this was before Zoom, between some grandparents and their grandchild. They're speaking Hebrew, and the grandparents, there's a Hanukkah in the background, snow on the ground, so we can assume it's Hanukkah. And of course, snow on the ground where the child's living means they're not living in Israel. And the grandparents say, "Oh, do you know what holiday is coming up?" And the child said, "Yeah, Christmas." And then it's kind of like the da-dun and the Law and Order thing. I don't think that noise is actually in it, but it sort of has that feeling. Screen goes blank, and there's a voiceover that says, they will always be Israeli. Their children will not, you know. And this idea of, you know, Christmas, this kind of Christian boogeyman, this assimilationist boogeyman, again, the perils, again, of exile, right, that can be corrected or avoided simply by, in this case, for Israelis living outside of Israel, returning to Israel. But certainly, you know, that is the kind of the negative valence that's attached to diaspora, is this kind of exilic diaspora as an exilic condition that can be corrected with immigration to or returned to the land of Israel and the state of Israel.
Right. And you kind of touched on this before, but just to give you a chance to elaborate, you write that the elevation of homeland, Zion, Jerusalem, the land of Israel, over diaspora is a modern phenomenon. What do you mean by that?
I mean that with the establishment of the state of Israel, maybe actually what I should have written is that that phenomenon as an institutional phenomenon is modern and really is something that we see beginning with the establishment of the state and the institutions of the state, like, for example, the Ministry of Immigrant Absorption, for example, is one thing, that you know, the state of Israel has created all kinds of organizational capabilities, institutional capabilities around that are organized around this notion of diaspora and exile as a negative thing, right? And I can't emphasize enough, as something that should be corrected, right, and fixed by movement to the homeland. And one other thing I want to say about that is the effect that relates particularly to the kind of theoretical framework of my book is that positioning, right, and that institutional framework, organizational framework, epistemological framework, that sort of reifies Israel or homeland and diaspora into these two separate, discrete, and oppositional concepts, right? Not just two different places, right? But it makes them into these conceptual frameworks for culture, for thought, for society, and how we organize our Jewish society, if we want to think about it that way, in a global sense, and. You know, one of the things that I'm trying to do in the book, and that even the term diaspora Israeli culture is designed to kind of force us to think about, is the ways that these two concepts of diaspora or exile and homeland or Israel can't actually be separated from each other, right? All of the kind of institutional framework designed to reify them as these separate and oppositional things, ideas, is really obscuring something much more powerful, which is that diaspora and Israel have always been, as we see in that sketch from Hayyudim Bayim, right, and still are implicated in each other, influences on each other, inseparable from each other in so many ways, that I think is a much more productive way for us to think about them, and also produces much more nuanced, useful kind of ways of thinking about the politics of these two ideas and also these two places, right? Because there is a, as we've of course seen in the last week, a really, you know, urgent kind of field of political discourse around these two concepts. that needs to be reckoned with. And one of the ways that we can reckon with it is, in my thinking, is through this concept of diaspora Israeli culture.
Right. And we're going to return a bit later on to talk about some of the political ramifications. So we definitely want to touch on that soon. I'm curious, what are some of the works of speculative fiction you explore that provide alternative outcomes of the Zionist project?
Yeah, so these are really interesting novels. And happily, I also just want to say at the outset, before we talk about any of the material, most of the material in the book is available in English to interested readers. Actually, of the speculative fiction novels that I'll tell you about, there's three that I focus on in the book. One of them is not available in English, but if any English language publishers would like to publish it in English, it should be published in English. That book is a book called Herzl Amar by the writer Yoav Avni. That translates to Herzl Said. Herzl refers to Theodore Herzl, who was the kind of founding father of Zionism and Zionist thought and in the 19th century. And that book postulates a world in which a state of Israel exists, but it does not exist in the biblical land of Israel. It exists in East Africa, because in that book, a different historical path has been taken. In 1903, the British colonial government offered a parcel of land to the Zionist Congress, a parcel of land in East Africa. It was known as Uganda at the time, but the place where this land is now the country of Kenya, mostly. For settlement, for Jewish settlement, and for the eventual establishment of a Jewish homeland. I'm not going to get into the reasons why this happened, but for a variety of reasons, the proposal was rejected and didn't go forward. But Avni's novel imagines a world in which it did. And then there's another English language novel by the writer Levi Tidhar, called Unholy Land, that also imagines a Jewish homeland in East Africa. That one's a little more complicated because it also involves some time travel and parallel universes. And in one of the parallel universes, there actually is a Jewish homeland, or was one in the biblical land of Israel that's been destroyed. So that's also interesting in and of itself. And then the final novel I consider in that chapter is a novel called, in Hebrew, Israel, or in English, Israel. And that's by the late Israeli writer Nava Semel, and translated into English by Jessica Cohen. In an excellent translation, so it is available in English. And that actually imagines a different alternative homeland that was once proposed in the 19th century by an American Jewish statesman named Mordechai Manuel Noah, who proposed a parcel of land on Grand Island, New York, an island in the Hudson River, for a Jewish homeland. And in that novel, which also involves some parallel time kind of machinations, in one part of the novel, there is a Jewish state on Grand Island, New York, that's one of the United States. And a part of the plot of that section of the novel is that a woman, a politician from Grand Island, Jewish politician, who's actually a descendant of Mordechai Manuel Noah, is running for president of the United States. And so, yeah, all very entertaining and interesting novels that sort of go back to these plans for alternative homelands that existed during the period when Zionism was kind of casting around for this solution to what they framed as the problem of exile. And when there were a lot of different ideas about what that solution might be.
Right. And so what do these alternative histories suggest regarding the nature of the Jewish homeland?
Yeah, so a number of different things. Of course, interestingly, None of them are utopias. And I think that's important because, for example, there's a precedent. Theodore Herzl himself wrote a novel called Altneuland, Old New Land, in which he imagined, he died long, long, long before the establishment of the State of Israel, even before the most significant Jewish settlement in Palestine. But he imagined a future Jewish homeland in Palestine that was this utopian paradise. I mean, we can argue whether it actually is utopian or not because, you know, there's he was also immersed in the, you know, politics of his time. But he tried to sort of create this technological, egalitarian utopia where Jews and Arabs live in harmony together and all this stuff. And so, you know, the sort of precedent, I think, at least in Jewish literature, right, for thinking about alternative homelands or is utopia. And these novels are not utopian. In fact, in many of them, maybe in all of them, to a certain extent, the kinds of problems that political problems, social problems that we find in our own modern day state of Israel are reproduced in the societies that are imagined there. So, you know, I think one of the things that can tell us is, look, these problems would have existed wherever we are, right? These are post-colonial problems. Wherever the Jews were going to settle was going to be in a land in which, there's no empty land, right? There are indigenous populations in all of these places. And, we would have faced the same issues wherever we went. I think that's one thing we might take away from it.
Right. Could you briefly describe Ruby Namdar's novel, The Ruined House, and Maya Arad's novella, The Hebrew Teacher?
Yeah, these two are actually quite different, but they have in common that they're both Hebrew novels written in the United States by writers who make their homes here. Ruby Namdar's novel is about an American Jewish college professor who begins to have what appears to be like a nervous breakdown of sorts and has visions of the temple in Jerusalem appear to him in New York, the temple, and then eventually its destruction by the Romans. And so we have this actual quite literal mixing of, Zion or homeland and diaspora, where there's sort of these rips in his visions, at least these kind of rips in the space-time continuum. And all of a sudden, you know, there's Levite priests walking down the streets of Manhattan and things like that. And, right. And then Maya Arad's novella is a bit different. And I should also note that this novella is the one I primarily focus on in the book, but Maya Arad has written many books. She's been living in the United States for decades, and she's written many books that touch on American life and American Jewish life. A lot of her books are set in the United States. And but this book is interesting. It's titled The Hebrew Teacher, and it's really about questions of language and also this politics of Israel and diaspora, which come up in the novella. And it centers around a Hebrew instructor at an unnamed Midwestern university whose classes are becoming less and less popular, who's sort of doubting her place in the world as the politics of Israel and diaspora change and fewer diaspora Jews want to take Hebrew, for example. And she begins writing a memoir. And so the first words of the novel are actually in English because she's sort of trying to decide whether she writes her memoir in Hebrew or in English, right? Where is she positioned with regard to her Israeliness now that she's spent so many decades outside of Israel, even though she's immersed in, you know, the language and culture of Israel in a very real way. So, yeah.
All right. And what do Namdar and Arad's works say about the Jewish diaspora and its links to Israel, as well as the survival of global Jewish culture?
Yeah, so to me, the most interesting thing about these books is, and this is true in a sort of inverse way for the translingual English literature that I discuss as well, is the question of language. And because Hebrew, of course, has really been inextricably tied to the Zionist project, and since the establishment of the state, to the state of Israel. Not just Hebrew, but Hebrew culture as a mode of establishing a specifically Israeli culture that, again, is in contrast to is in contrast to diaspora Jewish culture. I mean, we could go back even to the pronunciation issue that I noted at the beginning of our conversation, right? Israeli Hebrew pronunciation was chosen very consciously to be different than Ashkenazi Hebrew pronunciation.
European Hebrew. European exactly. Pronunciation of Hebrew.
Exactly. Ashkenazi, right. European diasporic pronunciations of Hebrew because it was going to be a new language, a new culture that was a Hebrew culture. And so even just to write a book in Hebrew, a novel in Hebrew, that's set in the United States, right, where theoretically the people speaking in the book, even though it's written in Hebrew, they're speaking in English, right? And you know, in both of these books, we have elements of American culture kind of translated into Hebrew. In Ruby's book, kind of classic American show tunes, for example, that he translates into the Hebrew because, you know, they're things that the character's grandmother sang to him when he was young. In Maya Rod's book, we find something interesting that you don't find very much, which is, you know, American Jewish characters using Yiddishisms, which are so common in American Jewish speech. But something that was really consciously kind of eradicated from Jewish speech in Israel in favor of Hebrew. And so, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've been surprised when I've been in Israel when I use a word that's common in Jewish culture in America that's obviously a Yiddish word or derived from Yiddish, and Israelis are like, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, and I'm like, how, what, you know, how is that possible? But it really is true, right? Hebrew was really meant to kind of just pave over not just European Jewish culture and languages, but also the cultures and languages of Jews from around the world, right? It just happened that founding fathers of Zionism were themselves Ashkenazi, and that was, you know, was and often still is the kind of dominant, you know, subculture in Israel. But the very way that Hebrew is used in these novels creates a kind of challenge to that idea of Hebrew as this sort of exclusively, you know, Israeli language. And by the way, one other thing I'll say about that that also comes up later in the book is that one of the things this does is sort of force Hebrew to contend with the fact of its origins in the diaspora. That's another thing that was paved over by early Zionists, by the state of Israel, is that Hebrew is not an indigenous language to Palestine or to Israel. Hebrew is a European language. Modern Hebrew, that is. Modern Hebrew was developed in the literature of European Jews in the cafes of the great cities of Europe in the 19th century. And it came to Palestine with Zionist settlers. So, you know, one of the things that writing these books does, even if not explicitly, is it sort of reminds us and forces us to reckon with the fact that, you know, Hebrew has never actually been exclusively associated with Israel, but has rather also and been a diaspora language and a diaspora construction.
Right. And you touched on this before, but could you just clarify a little bit, what exactly is translingualism and how does it show up in Israeli literature?
Yeah, translingualism is the phenomenon of literature that's written by authors writing in a non-native language. And in my book, I look at some translingual English works of fiction by Israeli writers. In particular, the books I mentioned earlier, The People of Forever Are Not Afraid by Shani Boyanju and The Best Place on Earth by Ayelet Sabari, as well as a slightly older book that's actually kind of sort of a mix of genres by the Israeli activist and writer Rela Mazzali. These works, in a way, they kind of are the inverse of the Hebrew language works that are being written in the United States and the diaspora. These are English language works that are Israeli literature. And actually, there is now a lot of Israeli literature that's not in Hebrew, right? There's a huge, Russian-speaking population in Israel that has their own Russian language literature. There have always been English language writers in Israel. They have their own association, most of them immigrants from English-speaking countries who are not writing translingual literature. But this phenomenon of Israelis writing in English about deeply, deeply Israeli topics and landscapes and ideas is kind of a newer one. In particular, what I noticed about these works, which of course are written by women, is that it seems to allow for a kind of examination of topics that are often elided or taboo or historically have been. Now a lot of these topics enter into Israeli culture and Israeli literature, but have historically been elided or taboo or even just really not considered as much in Hebrew language literature and culture. It seems to provide a certain kind of freedom in a way to look at those topics in a kind of critical way.
Right. So you note that some of these works offer a critique of Zionist tropes. Could you give some examples of how this plays out?
Yeah. I think a lot of this occurs around gender and sexuality. There are a lot of the Ayelet Sabari's book is a book of short stories. And a lot of her characters are characters that in various ways encounter these kind of constructions of gender that they don't, particularly Israeli constructions of gender that they just simply don't fit into. For example, she has a story that's about a young Mizrahi boy Mizrahi is a word that's used in Israel. It's kind of a catch-all term that's used to refer to Jews of non-European heritage. In this case, he's Iraqi. His family is Iraqi, who likes to write. He's a poet. But he's sort of given all these messages that writing and poetry are not masculine, and that the way to be a man is to, you know, be in the military and to hide your feelings, right? Not to express them through writing. And it's sort of about him finding the role models that show him this, that there is an alternate kind of path to constructing one's identity as an Israeli, and particularly a Mizrahi Israeli boy. And, you know, so again, those are topics and ideas that have often been invisible in Israeli culture that really come to the surface in this book. And that's just one example. I would say in almost all of the stories in that book, you encounter some kind of, you know, challenge provided to like an Israeli trope, especially of gender.
Right. And in addition to looking at works of literature, you also explore Yael Bartana's video installation titled "And Europe Will Be Shunned, Will Be Stunned." Could you tell us a little bit about that video installation?
Yeah, Yael Bartana is an Israeli artist. She works a lot in the video medium, but she also has other works. And this was a series of three videos that were produced in the early 2000s and 2010s. I think from about 2008 to 2011, if I'm not mistaken, around that time, that document a fictional political movement in Poland called the Jewish Renaissance Movement in Poland, that led by a charismatic Polish politician who's played actually by a Polish journalist, I believe. And their political program calls for the return of Jews to Poland as a mode of healing, which is complicated and problematic in and of itself. But in particular, the second video is very interesting because what it documents is the settlement of a group of Israeli Jewish pioneers in Warsaw, in Muranov Square, which actually this it was made before the Pauline Museum stood there. So now I'm not even actually sure the little piece of grass on which they can construct their kibbutz is still there because the museum was built afterwards. But yeah, they come into Warsaw and they build what is like essentially a little kibbutz in the middle of Warsaw, Muranov Square, which was the historically the Jewish neighborhood before the Shoah. And they create this little settlement. They have a flag. This is the JRMIP, the Jewish Renaissance Movement in Poland, have a little flag that combines both the Star of David and the Polish eagle. All the videos are fascinating. I'm pretty sure the first one is available on her website. But the second one is really interesting because it raises, of course, all these questions of obviously it reverses the movement of, you know, return to the homeland, right? In this case, returning to the diaspora. So it envisions the diaspora as a kind of homeland. But it also recalls and kind of reproduces some of the problematics of settlement, right, that we see leveled against Zionist settlement as well, namely, right, the displacement of whoever's already there. There's a scene where, you know, people walking through the square kind of come up to this kibbutz that's appeared overnight and like are looking at like, what is this? And why is it in the middle of my, you know, the place I walk my dog? And, you know, it's silly in a way, but it calls our attention to some of these questions and asks whether, again, like the speculative fiction I mentioned, whether these are not just questions that we need to contend with wherever they arise, right? That plague us, that might trouble us in the diaspora as much as they do in the homeland. At the same time as it kind of also in a way makes an impassioned case for a diaspora Jewish identity that was lost, right? There's a kind of nostalgia involved in the project as well.
Yeah. I mean, to add to that, I understand that now in Eastern Europe, over, I don't know, the past bunch of years, there've been, movements, sort of cultural developments where local residents, people who are not Jewish, have often embraced sort of klezmer music or other aspects of Jewish, European culture, and tried to celebrate it even in the absence of actual living, Jews who have been, killed by the Holocaust, or people who, went to Israel and other places, but there's like this kind of nostalgic move to somehow center parts of the, Jewish cultural expression in locations that used to be central to those Jewish, cultural expressions.
Right, but absent actual Jews, right? It's like a theoretical Judaism in a way, or it's theoretical Jewish culture. Right, which has its own problematics. And in a way, this also calls attention to that, I think. And these videos also call attention to that, and actually even maybe are formulate a kind of response to that phenomenon as well, which I think is interesting. If you go to a few years ago for a conference, I was in Warsaw and Krakow, and there's a whole section of Krakow in the old Jewish area of Kashmir's where there's just a kind of street full of, restaurants that are, they have klezmer bands come and play, and they have, like Jewish food, which some of which was totally unrecognizable to me, even though that's essentially the area where my, own roots lie. And, I thought I knew what Ashkenazi Jewish food was, but it also I think kind of engages with that impulse, in particular in the call for healing, right? This kind of sort of political platform of this party, part of it is that the return of the Jews will heal this wound of the Holocaust, without reference to the fact that it was partly the responsibility of Poland, right? That it created that wound too, or participated in its creation. I know probably that would get me canceled in Poland, I'm pretty sure.
Right. This is right. The question of the role of the Polish state and of Polish citizens in the carrying out of the decimation of Jews during the Holocaust has become a political issue, and there are laws now that prevent honest discussion of these issues in Poland right now.
Yes, absolutely. And that also comes up in a very explicit way, like especially in the third video, which is a funeral essentially, and where these eulogies are given, but the eulogies end up being kind of these political statements, right? So it ends up providing a variety of kind of political responses to these questions. In a little bit of a didactic way, but actually it works. So that issue and those questions come up. I mean, it's a very, it would be hard in just a few minutes to sort of go through and even describe all of the very complex, nuanced issues and references and allusions that kind of come up in these videos. I mean, of course, the video medium, it also alludes to these, especially the scenes of the pioneers coming to Warsaw, to these old Zionist films of the, and there are very specific allusions in the video to certain of these films. Especially by the filmmaker Helmar Lursky, of these, Zionist films showing Jewish settlers coming into Palestine to settle it. Again, one of the things that is consistent between those films and Bartana's work is the kind of absence of, in the case of the Zionist, old Zionist films, any indigenous population, right? You never see Arabs. And in Bartana's film, until that last little scene where there's a few, you know, Warsawians coming up to see what's going on, people, right? This is a big square in the middle of a city. These people just come in and build a kibbutz there. There's nobody there. You don't see them. They must be there, but you don't see them, you know? So there's this kind of reference to the elision of the population that's being displaced there, and the problematics of that. Yeah.
Right. So speaking of the indigenous population and the problematics of covering that up, and we certainly don't want to be guilty of that in our discussion, could we shift gears a little bit and talk about the relationship between the kind of expansive vision of Jewish belonging articulated in your book and the ongoing treatment of Palestinians in Israel-Palestine?
Yeah, so one thing I'll say, and we didn't touch very much on the last chapter of the book, which is about a group of Israelis in Berlin who are trying to create a culture of what they call diasporic Hebrew, which really specifically references some of the things I've mentioned before. And that is really an explicitly like political project that is actually you know, designed to make some of these connections that I've noted are sort of elusive and subtextual in a lot of the work that I study in the book. They really want to make those explicit, and those activists in Berlin, writers and scholars, artists and performers, have tried to explicitly tie their work on what they call diasporic Hebrew to other communities, Mizrahi Jews, to draw on a kind of what, and again, this is something that's open for critique, maybe what they see as a natural affinity between Mizrahi Jews or Arab Jews. Many of them think of themselves as Arab Jews. To other Arab diaspora communities in Berlin, and to form a kind of political solidarity across that that also recalls the notion of Levantinism proposed by the writer Jacqueline Kahanoff. So I think, you know, there are some perhaps explicitly political conclusions that you could draw from some of this work. And I do think that the kind of Berlin group and discussed in the last chapter tries to do that. Many of the works also, as I've mentioned, the speculative fiction novels, Yael Bartana's work, certainly, the translingual literature I mentioned, that specifically I think ties their work to a kind of a project of critique of maybe one, the invisibility of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, of Palestinians generally, of Palestinian culture and belonging in the state, even in the state of Israel, not just in the occupied territories, to their work, right? That they try, to varying degrees and maybe to varying degrees of success also. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, there's kind of this overt attempt to do this, but I do think that often, sometimes even I think inadvertently, it brings those issues to the fore through the kind of critiques of various elements of the Zionist project and Zionist tropes that are present in that work. So that's one thing I'll say. Another thing I'll say, which actually I haven't really talked about very much, is that when I first started writing the book, I actually considered writing another chapter that would feature the work of Palestinian writers who write in Hebrew. And then I, as I thought more about it, I thought that really didn't do their work justice in a way. And I wasn't sure that it was fair or right even to try to fit those writers into a framework that was really ultimately a Jewish framework, right? I start the book from this premise of diaspora as a Jewish exile. And however, I do see, for example, in the work of Syed Kashua, who's probably one of the most beloved and best known writers of Hebrew literature, now lives actually outside of Israel. Some of the same themes and ideas that I've identified in this work. So one day maybe I'll go back to that and try to give it its own framework within the context of the kinds of things that I've been discussing, because I do think there is some relationship and connection there that's important to draw out.
Right, right. And I wonder specifically, like, these days, I mean, the past week or so, there's been horrific acts of brutality against Israeli civilians, and then the Israeli state responded with horrific acts of brutality against Palestinian civilians, and many Jews around the world have been engaged on social media and responding to this kind of a stream of violence. And I'm wondering how you see, if you see any of the themes in your book relating to how Jews in the diaspora are responding to these events in Israel-Palestine the past, you know, week or so.
Yeah, so I've thought about this a lot. Obviously, it's hard not to when you just publish a book about a region that is then, you know, of course, first of all, suffers terrible attacks and losses and is also kind of plunged into a kind of chaos, right, at this point. And I thought really of two specific things in my work that I think can help us, you know, think about this. And you know, I'm kind of I'm like a reluctant optimist, maybe. Help us talk about it, because one of the things I've really noticed, and I've experienced this myself, is, I mean, obviously people are hurting, but it always happens around this issue, a real tendency to attack each other without listening, and an almost a need to attack as a response. And so two things I would say. One is that all of the work that I consider in my book is work that in various ways and various means and with different kinds of political orientations imagines a different present and therefore different future. And I think, you know, it really points to the way that in times like these, literature, art, culture can be really important and a guide to us, a comfort certainly, but also a guide because it's the realm of imagination. And I think one thing that we know is that clearly whatever we've done, whatever we are doing is not working, right? It continues to result in this kind of violence over and over. And I guess my hope would be that, you know, looking to this, to literature, to art, to film, to all of these, popular culture, which I also talk about in the book, is an avenue or vehicle for imagining something different for ourselves and something better. And I do think that this work in particular provides some specific ways and modes of doing that, right? It helps us to move us out of the kind of ruts in our thinking that we're in. And that brings me to my second point. That idea that we're kind of stuck in these ways of thinking, and particularly in binaries, right? The binary that I mentioned in the beginning, the way that Israel and diaspora have been constructed is this oppositional binary where as if there's these two, again, antagonistic notions. And, you know, when you scratch the surface a little bit, again, you see that that's not the case. And it's actually never the case, right? That's what it reminds us. It's never the case that two ideas, two concepts, two things are always oppositional and antagonistic. And, you know, even the phrase that I use, diaspora Israeli culture, which I explained in the introduction, reminds us that you can hold two ideas in your mind, in your heart, in your head, at the same time, right? Even two ideas that you've been told or taught or have been constructed as discrete and oppositional. Again, we can imagine and we can rethink the ways that those two ideas actually do meet and do touch each other and do impinge upon each other, influence each other. And I think that that's really, really important, both in terms of how we speak to each other about these issues that are so divisive and complicated and you know, tense and hard, but also, again, about how we imagine something different.
Right, right. Well, on that, as you say, sort of potentially optimistic note, we will end it for now. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate the chance also to get to relate my work to, you know, current events.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.